morning and welcome to Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart. It's the final Friday of the month, which means it's time to reconvene the American Classics Book Club. And today's book is In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. I look forward to your texts, your calls and your tweets. It's nice to be with you on RN this Friday morning. Yes, In Cold Blood. It was serialised in the New York Magazine in 1965 and then published as a book the following year. And it's based on an actual crime, the brutal murder of the Clutter family in small town Kansas in November 1959 and, of course, on the search for their killers. Truman Capote was already a famous writer when he produced In Cold Blood, especially when it was published in 1966. He'd published the bestseller Breakfast at Tiffany's almost a decade earlier, and it had already been made into a hit film, which I'm sure you'll know, the film with Audrey Hepburn. Capote's interest was triggered in this story by a small newspaper item about the murder, which he read in the New York Times. This act of cruelty inspired him to travel 400 miles across the country and spend 6 years interviewing, researching and writing about these killings. So what was it about the murders that drew him in? Let's hear from Truman Capote himself.
In Cold Blood is the story about the murder of a family in a small town in western Kansas, a Mr. Herbert W. Clutter and his wife, Bonnie Clutter, and their two teenage children. This was an especially strange and brutal murder in 1959, in which the family was shot, gunned to death, for no apparent cause or motive whatever.
The unmistakable voice of Truman Capote speaking there about the Clutter murders, which are the basis for his book In Cold Blood. It's been translated into more than 30 languages and it's inspired 3 major movies, all very good movies, I think. So I want to know what you think about this book, and if you want to come on air, I'll give you the number for that shortly. But in the meantime, I'm here to keen to hear your thoughts on Twitter, or if you'd text us, that would be good too. So you can tweet if you use the hashtag RNBooksAndArts. That's RN Books and Arts. And you can text us on 0418 22 65 76. That's 0418 22 65 76. And I'll give the talkback number in just a little while. Let's meet the guests. Dr. Ralph Voss is a retired professor of English at the University of Alabama. He's the author of Truman Capote and the Legacy of In Cold Blood, and he joins us from a studio in Alabama. Ralph, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Andrew Rule is also in the studio. He's in the Melbourne studio. He's one of the country's leading crime journalists. He writes for the Herald Sun newspaper in Melbourne. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
And Omar Figueres is a Florida-based writer. He's co-editor of the online literary journal Blood Lotus, and he says that his own writing has been inspired by In Cold Blood. Omar, it's nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So, Ralph Voss, let's start with you. You're from Kansas, and you actually remember the murders of the Clutter family. What do you remember?
Well, everyone was shocked. Kansas in 1959 seemed a very remote place, a very safe place, rural, agricultural, small town, and the Clutters were exemplary citizens of the state. Mr. Clutter was pretty well known as a wheat grower and as a kind of model farmer and rancher, and that this terrible crime had happened in their home out in Holcomb, Kansas. The news spread rapidly around the state. People were very fearful. I was in high school at the time, and up until that time, my parents had never locked our doors at night. But locks sold out at hardware stores all over the state, and it was a very shocking notion that something like this could happen in our community.
And did people at that time know that this book was being written, that Truman Capote was writing the book?
Not immediately, no. Capote was in the state not long after the murders. Originally, he was going to write a story for the New Yorker magazine about the impact of such a terrible crime on such a small kind of insular community. But when the killers were captured, He expanded the project, and that's was the genesis of In Cold Blood. I personally didn't know that he was at work on the book until around 1963, when there was an article in Newsweek magazine that reported he had done a reading of some of the manuscript in New York as a sort of preview, and the notion was that he hadn't published anything since Breakfast at Tiffany's, and people were kind of curious about what he was doing, and that's when I found out about it. And then, of course, later on, the killers were executed and the book came out.
Yes, it's a long silence, isn't it? Breakfast at Tiffany's came out in 1958, so we're that's now right. into the early 60s, and he hasn't done anything else. So let's just fill in people who are not up to speed with this. The Clutters are brutally murdered in the dead of night. This is November the 14th, 1959. What do we learn from the crime scene about the murder? What's to be seen?
Are you asking me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. There were so few clues. The victims had been bound, gagged, and there were no shotgun shells. The knife that was used to cut Mr. Clutter's throat was not in evidence. It wasn't until after the crime scene photographs had been developed that there were some boot prints visible on the prints made from the crime scene photographs that indicated two different sets of boot prints in the Clutter basement. And that's when they realized that there had been, most likely, had been two killers. But there was so little else to go on.
Was also a couple of strange details that suggests that one of the murderers, if there were indeed two, had been somehow emotionally involved with the victims, or at least tender towards them.
Well, yes, it was. It puzzled the Kansas Bureau of Investigation officers, who noticed that Mr. Clutter was not on the cold concrete floor, but had been put on a box, a large box that had originally held a mattress. And the son, Kenyon Clutter, who was also in the basement, had been apparently made comfortable on the couch. It looked as if, strangely, these brutal murderers had shown a desire to make the victims more comfortable.
Hmm. Andrew Rule, who is a crime reporter in Melbourne, you read this book when?
I first read it as an impressionable youth, and I reread it as an impressionable 20-something reporter, and I do believe I've read it since then. Each time I've appreciated its the craft, the tension, and the structure. As I've become, a professional writer myself, in later years, I've realised that it probably there's probably some flaws there. I'm not as quite as impressed with it as I once was.
Let's come to the flaws. We'll certainly come to the flaws, but let's paint the picture and establish what he's achieved, and then we can interrogate that. So, as someone who's in the game yourself, do you feel as though he's in some ways a fellow traveller?
Oh, indeed. I think that Truman Capote was first to do this sort of thing, to apply the skills of the novelist to the true crime, and to build something that has great tension and great believability, and he creates a structure which will probably not unique. I mean, Faulkner used a similar braided narrative; other people did too, but to apply it to a real case was something new, and it was brilliant. And I think it's inspired probably thousands of long form journalists to write something like that. There are Truman Capote has many, many children.
Well, that opening sequence, or that opening phase, where you're seeing the Clutters going about their wholesome family business, and you're seeing these two guys who you gradually come to understand are two very bad men who are on a journey. And you know, because you know what the book's about, that these two life stories are going to converge. And it's incredibly clearly structured. Yeah. It's so obvious in a way, but it's just such a beautiful and inevitable progression of the two to a meeting place.
Two rivers meeting.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Powerful stuff. Figueres, what about you? You say that you drew on Truman Capote's narrative style in your own writing. What drew you into this book?
Well, I had read it as a young, impressionable college student, and then much later as well. While in my MFA program, I had gone through the book and read it for style. And Andrew had said, the braided structure of it is something that had been used before, but just his application to something that is CNF, contemporary creative nonfiction, it was just brand new. And also the way that the tension builds, because you know everything that happens. You know exactly what happens, except for the details of the actual crime itself. And that's what's withheld to the very end. And also the very presence of the writer, of the, quote, reporter. He's completely invisible throughout the entire book until almost close to the end. I believe it's in the lower, almost to the end, where Hickok makes a reference to the reporter visiting Perry. And that's the only vague appearance that you see Truman or, quote, the reporter in the book at all. And that had always fascinated me.
Yes, we might talk about that a bit more, because he's such an extreme character, so flamboyant in his performance of himself in real life. And when you see television interviews with him, he's an over-the-top character. And yet you can't feel his presence at all, really, as this over-the-top person. Ralph, do you have that sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think Omar is correct. I think the triumph of style in Cold Blood is that Capote retreated into the third-person narrator and erased his own pronounced first-person kind of personality. If you read some of his other nonfiction, such as The Muses Are Heard and the interview with Marlon Brando that was in The New Yorker, Hand-Carved Coffins, which came out several years after In Cold Blood. Mm-hmm. It's a first-person narration, and Capote becomes a big part of the story. He made, I think, In Cold Blood a classic by his discipline in kind of muting his own presence and letting the story come forward the way he presents it. I think that's the single greatest stylistic achievement of the book.
Mm. You're on Books and Arts. You're on Books and Arts Daily on RM with Michael Cathcart. We're in the American Classics Book Club, and we're talking about In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. With me are Dr. Ralph Voss, who's a retired professor of English at the University of Alabama and the author of Truman Capote and the Legacy of In Cold Blood, Andrew Rule, a well-known crime journalist based in Melbourne, and Omar Figueres, who is a crime writer who is joining us from Florida. So we've got some people have been tweeting. The tweets are flooding in. Vincent Avaro writes, In Cold Blood is long-form investigative journalism at its best, combined with a wonderful, wonderful and thrilling storytelling. Indeed it is. And Damien Payne writes, In Cold Blood, best book and film ever. Frightening. And the music is even better. Yes, we played a little bit that music right at the start of the show. So the talkback number is 1300 22 55 76. If you're in Eastern Australia, in the Eastern Australia daylight, no, don't need daylight, in the Eastern Australian time zone, do call us on 1300 22 55 76. If you're in Central Australia and call right now, you'll just beat the time difference. So 1300 22 55 76. If you're in the West, then you can join us online and have your say about the book, because it's so good to keep this conversation going over the days that come. So let's talk about the Clutters, Ralph, the All-American family. You were saying what respected people they were. Can you just give us a bit more of a kind of picture of who they all were?
Well, Herbert Clutter was a native Kansan, as was his wife, Bonnie. He went to Kansas State University, which is the agricultural and mechanical university. He was for a time a county agent, that is, one who advises farmers and ranchers in the management of the business of their farms and ranches. He was friendly, gregarious, a leader in the Methodist Church there in Garden City nearby, the county seat. He was president of the Kansas Wheat Growers Association. He was a member of President Eisenhower's Farm Credit Board, a leader in the 4-H clubs, just an outstanding citizen. And the children were good students at the local school. Nancy Clutter, the daughter, had just been in a class play at the Holcomb High School. She played Becky Thatcher in a production of Tom Sawyer. Capote suggests that Mrs. Clutter had some depression, maybe some emotional problems, although many of the people I talked to and who knew Bonnie Clutter did not like Capote's characterization of her that way, but they were very much a model family and highly respected in the community at large. And some people in the area said that they, of all the people in the world who might be murdered, the Clutters were the least likely. Mm. So it was, you know, they were pillars of the community.
So as I say in the opening phase of the book, their wholesome life is about to come unstuck because these two men are travelling towards them. Omar, perhaps you could paint a picture of these two men in the car. So they're Dick Hickok and Perry Smith. Who are they?
Who are they?
I'll get Omar to tell us about this thing.
At the moment, they're on the run. Well, when the book starts, they're already on their scavenger hunt, per se, to find these items that they need in order to commit their crime. And they're dead set to go ahead and pursue it. Perry seems to be the center, or rather the emotional touchstone of the two. He was the one of the two criminals that had that that compassion towards the victims that we were talking about earlier. And he was the one, admittedly, who murdered all four of them. So to see both ends of that spectrum held within the same individual is quite terrifying, I would figure. And Dick Hickok was the worst possible person that could possibly be out there, I think. And the way that Capote draws him as a pedophile and as an angry, violent individual is also completely frightening.
Yes. What do you make of them, Andrew?
Interesting. These are the two fellows that you could meet in any jail in any country in the world. We've got one damaged boy from a young age, that would be Perry, but both of them have been damaged in motor accidents. So their bodies and their minds have been knocked about by violence. They've taken painkillers and things like that. I think Perry's addicted to aspirin because of the pains in his legs from a motorcycle accident. Hickok's head is a funny shape because it's been so severely smashed up in a car accident. So these are damaged men in many ways, physically and mentally, and that informs what happens. I think, you know, that they're typical of... we've seen events in Melbourne recently where there's a youngish man that has committed a terrible crime who could fit this mould.
Mm. They have nowhere to go, these guys, do they? They're just so adrift.
They are. They're drifters. It underlines what we all know, and that is how totally banal most acts of evil are. That here these two idiots just dreaming up murdering a whole family on the basis of what? Because some other idiot in a jail cell said, oh, I used to work on a farm, and the guy was quite a wealthy farmer. He probably had a safe in the house.
So they've heard this story in prison that this man Clutter's got a safe full of, is it $10,000, something like that?
Yeah. Which is totally bogus. Yeah, and then they go and kill them. Yeah. This happens in...
Yeah, that was the career plan. You know, they just didn't look that far ahead. They planned it. Hickok planned it, recruited Smith, and it was all very random, and they are the polar opposites of the Clutters, and yet they came together in that house, and after the carnage, the killers left with about $40 in cash, a pair of binoculars, and a portable radio.
Mm. Right, $10 a head is what the book references.
Yeah. That's right, $10 a head. That's it.
The prosecuting attorney had said that, yes.
Let's go to some calls. We've got some people who've called us on 1300 22 55 76. You can add your call if you like. 1300 22 55 76. What do you make of the book? And what do you think about the sympathy, if there is any sympathy, for the killers? Elizabeth's in Brisbane. You say compassion's a major theme, Elizabeth.
Yes, I read the book about 5 years ago, and obviously, you know, it's an investigative crime thriller, but it's all, you also come out of it with a sort of a deep compassion for everybody involved, the victims and the killers themselves, because of their backstories, because Capote has done such a brilliant job of investigating the family life of both of them, and you see them, you know, as sort of victims in a way themselves of some of the uglier truths of American society, maybe broader Western society. I mean, Perry was in the war. They are on the fringes. They're people who you feel had everything stacked against them, and you never think that anybody deserved to die or that what they didn't do was what they did was anything other than awful and evil acts. But it also brings home how, you know, in that time, day and age, people like the Clutter family, you would have thought, were completely immune to that sort of evil, that they lived in a farming community far from anything ugly or awful, and they lived upright lives, etc., etc., etc. And yet it brings home to you that, you know, when there's trouble and difficulty and awful things in society, no one's safe from
it. Descends on them. Okay, Elizabeth, thanks for that call. You've made that point well. And in Canberra is Kerry. You see links between Cold Blood and To Kill a Mockingbird. Well, there are links. We'll talk about those in a tick. What were you going to say about that, Kerry?
Well, I love to read in Cold Blood because I love crime writing, but I was also fascinated when I was teaching in Cold Blood and researching the background to realise that with my favourite American novel of all time, To Kill a Mockingbird, that Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird is Truman Capote, apparently. Yes. And Capote took Harper Lee with him to Holcombe when he was researching the book because he realised that his extreme New York style might not get all that he needed out of the people of Holcombe as well. So those two links with two great American books I just found absolutely fascinating.
It is a fascinating link, Kerry, and we'll explore that now since you've raised that, so thank you for calling us. Ralph, so Capote was mates with Harper Lee. They'd known each other as children, had they?
That's correct. In tiny Monroeville, Alabama, which has maybe about 5,000 people, they were childhood friends, and he is the model for Dill Harris in To Kill a Mockingbird. And when I was in western Kansas interviewing people in the Garden City and Holcomb area, numerous people told me that it was Harper Lee that they liked at first. She was very personable, very gracious, and seemed to have a way of smoothing things when they were... to a great extent, many of them recoiled because he was very flamboyant, very obviously gay, and kind of mincing, and his voice that we heard earlier was off-putting, and he very likely would not have made much progress without her accompanying him. And many people give her a lot of credit for his ability to ingratiate himself in the community.
Andrew Rule, you have some views on this.
I totally agree. I think that it's a brilliant collaboration, and that without Truman needed Harper Lee to do it at all. And having done many, many interviews myself with people about things that I want to put in books, I realise how excellent it is to have some other person there, another person to do the talking and do the chatting and do the small talk, so that you can sit back and take notes and think. And I think the double hander in this case was brilliant and probably totally necessary.
And he returned the compliment, do you think, in relation to Kill a Mockingbird?
I believe so. Ralph will know this, and I'm guessing, but I suspect that Truman, being the brilliant novelist that he was, the most beautiful craftsman, most probably returned the favour with To Kill a Mockingbird.
What do you think, Ralph?
I don't know at what point he actually read all of the manuscript or parts of the manuscript. That is a topic of great interest and discussion here in Alabama, a state that's very proud of both of them. And there's a lot of speculation about how much she contributed to In Cold Blood's actual writing and vice versa. But she's not talking, by the way. She's had been reclusive most of her life since winning the Pulitzer Prize. And, of course, Capote is gone, so we'll really never know. But it's pretty clear that there was collaboration in the sense that she also made notes, In Cold Blood notes. They compared their notes in the evenings. They occasionally had disputes about wording or how they remembered things. But there's no question that she helped him with the facts and with the approaches to people. Now, to what extent, other than his presence when they were children, he may have influenced To Kill a Mockingbird in terms of its style and her writing of it, I don't know.
On Books and Arts Daily, this is Friday, the last Friday of the month, which means it's time to talk about an American classic. And our classic today is In Cold Blood with Truman Capote. And we're talking about it with you, the listener, and we're looking forward to your calls on 1300 22 55 76 or your texts on 0418 22 65 76. I'll do those numbers again. The call is 1300 22 55 76. The text number is 0418 22 65 76. Or you can tweet us using the hashtag RNBooksAndArts. Dr. Ralph Foss is with us. He's the author of Truman Capote and the Legacy of In Cold Blood. Andrew Rule is a well-known crime journalist in Melbourne, and Omar Figueres is a crime writer. Omar, we've had a text from an arts journalist named Fiona Gruber who's written this. Capote created a new genre, but in some ways the book was his undoing. The book made him a serious writer, but ruthless. What do you make of that?
Ruthless, per se. Well, I think he was always ruthless. but what it did was, in the style of it, the way that he wanted to proceed it, where he would not be present in the book, only in actually creating the text, I think, is what made him, you know, if not, I mean, in hindsight, probably the most ominous figure in the entire book, aside from the criminals here, because I remember there is a phrase in the beginning of the book when we first meet Dewey and the detective, and he's putting his case together, and he's looking at the crime pictures, and he tells his men that he wants them to find the hidden animals in these pictures. And the obvious hidden animal in all of this is he himself, you know. Now, after the book, I think the writing of this, the creation of this text probably sucked the life out of him completely, and it drained almost everything from him, because after that, I don't think he wrote much. He just began other projects, but never really got them finished. And also the lifestyle that he led was, you know, very self-destructive.
Mm.
So yeah. Is that what, by ruthless?
Well, I guess you can take it however you like, but as you say, the astonishing achievement is that he writes in this series of voices, none of which appears to be his, that you've actually got all sorts of people telling you the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They're coming from everywhere, even from the perspective, and it's one of my favorite characters in the entire book, Babe, the horse. So, you know, you even find out what happens to Babe, and that's also heartbreaking.
Andrew Rule, we've learned that Capote paid people to get interviews and the media were allowed to walk around the murder scene in an extraordinary way.
They were, but probably not extraordinary in rural United States in 1959. Even in my own experience since the 70s, things have changed enormously with crime scenes and with police and with access and with the sort of casual she'll be right attitude. Can you imagine, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s, the difference, particularly in the rural areas, if you had a friendship with particular police, you would be...
I would agree, Andrew. Yeah. I would agree that there wasn't even a constable in Holcomb, and the Finney County Sheriff was the first investigator per se, and then they quickly called in the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, which is headquartered in Topeka, which is some 300 miles away. And then the Kansas Bureau of Investigation turned the case over to Alvin Dewey, and he became the contact that Capote and Harper Lee had, that in terms of getting firsthand information about the investigation. But there's no question that he had extraordinary access to the crime scene and to the killers when they were in the Finney County Jail, and then later when they were in the Kansas State Penitentiary. He was able to come and go and see them on death row, and that was unprecedented. But I guess in defense of my rural home state, they had never seen anything like this before, and there was no protocol, no model that they could follow. It was a huge, huge case, and they were having to sort of develop that case as they went along.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. We're talking about In Cold Blood, the murder of the Clutter family in Holcomb. Let's hear what some of the residents of Holcomb had to say about all of this.
And then along comes a little short guy with a funny accent. And if it hadn't been for him and his buddy, most people, it'd be pretty well forgotten.
And I know he came out fairly quick and kind of made that first survey and stayed at our motel. He stayed in the same room all the time while he was riding, coming and going, of course. It was kind of funny. My dad was working at the front counter at the time, answering the switchboard. And at first he would say, "Yes, ma'am," to Truman because his voice was so high.
Most people didn't want to talk about it. They came out and interviewed me. I didn't want to talk to them and was reluctant to talk to him.
I still think he did a good job of writing it. Maybe there were little things in there that he stressed or exaggerated, but I don't know about them.
To me, the book is no more than buying a sleaze magazine, and I know they say it's supposed to be a good written book, but I just can't. I can't buy it.
So there you go. There's a range of responses to the writing of this book from people who actually lived in Holcomb, the town where these murders were committed. That's taken from an online documentary marking the 50th anniversary of the book that was put together by Newsweek magazine. Ralph, since the publication of the book, some residents have come forward to say that not all of In Cold Blood is accurate. Can we talk about some of the discrepancies?
Yes, there were discrepancies that were mostly minor. But because Capote had made the claim that it was 100% true and predicted that the book would be a classic, it was practically a challenge to scholars and critics to do their own investigating. And there are points of contention that as small as the amount of money paid at the auction for Nancy's horse when the Clutter Estate auction was held. Capote reported that it was sold to a farmer for a certain amount of money, and then records showed that someone else had actually bought it for a different amount of money. A very, very minor discrepancy. Among the major distortions that could have made a difference is the for example, Perry Smith's confession in the book, we understand by way of Capote that Perry confessed in the car on the way back to Finney County from Las Vegas where they were caught, and that the details of his confession as we have them in Capote's In Cold Blood differ from the transcript of that confession as dictated back in Garden City and signed by Smith. I think the chief interesting thing is Perry's state of mind, that Capote speculates about Perry's state of mind when he actually, when the killings actually took place, and his feelings about, Perry's feelings about Hickok, because the whole scheme had blown up. They were not getting any money. They were in this in the house. They had been seen. The Clutters could have identified them, and the plan was to kill all the witnesses. And there's a suggestion that Smith may have dispatched the Clutters as a way of showing up Hickok, but then he was so dependent on Hickok, so aimless in his own life, that he still accompanied, that they didn't have a falling out about it. But there are a great many minor discrepancies. I think the book, in terms of all the most important details, it's extremely factual.
Omar, what do you think? Is the novel, or whatever it is, this factual book, supposedly factual book, undermined by these inaccuracies or these novelist pieces of novelist's license?
At all. I believe that it's just a matter of construction, because at the end of the day, I think all work is probably considered fiction, even if it is considered true, quote-unquote, this actually happened in real life, because as a writer, you need to shape narrative. And in order to do so, you have to have style and structure, as Andrew was talking about, and as Dr. Voss was also mentioning, that it's the way that Capote told the story. And I know that having read some of his letters there as well during the time that he was writing the book, where he had fused conversations, he had one conversation with Perry where actually he used a friend of Perry's instead, where they were having the dinner together, the last meal, and in their jail cell. And it was just a matter of having to mold it, you know, like clay itself, in order to get the best possible book written.
And Omar, how much license are you prepared to give a writer who claims that they're writing true crime? Because there is a difference between someone making up a crime to entertain people and someone
reporting
a crime that actually happened.
Correct. Well, the way that Capote was using it here was just to style the narrative, but the details of the crime itself and the events were all true. It was just a matter of that one section there. And I believe that, you know, if you're going to style it in that sort of way, that's okay. But when you start to change actual facts, then might as well call the book fiction.
Andrew Rule, you're a crime journalist. You have to have your facts right.
We do. The short answer to this is, I think Capote created a work of art, and it's brilliant, and it has influenced so many people since. However, many of those people that he's influenced, who do now write long-form journalism, or have in the last 40 years, would be less casual with real events than he has been. And I suspect, I can't prove this, but I suspect that the reconstruction of conversations is, although quite entertaining, is highly suspect. If you weren't there and you weren't taping people back in 1959... before this happened, how can you possibly know what was said?
He claimed he had 94% recall. I don't know how you quantify these things.
But he's reconstructing conversations where he wasn't.
Wasn't there, yeah.
And, you know, the dog ran out and licked his fingers and so on. Now, it's beautiful, and it's beautiful to read, and I accept that he did it, and I love it. However, I couldn't possibly file a story with that sort of detail and expect to get away with it now.
We'll come to the trial in a minute, but I don't want you to lose your opportunity to actually talk about the flaws that you were referring to earlier on. I mean, where do you think it falls short?
Well, I think I've just pointed that out. Really, the reconstructions of conversations,
right,
although done brilliantly by him, it's a mark of the author, and we see this a lot, of the true crime author trying to make something more lively, more authentic, more interesting, and they come up with little scenes and little conversations, yeah, and things that they can't possibly know to be,
yeah,
true.
Okay. So there's just a little
guessing,
too much license. Yeah, and I think when you're reading critically, you do think, yeah, how
does he know
how
that?
How do you know that? Even if you were talking to everybody over 6 years. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. It's the last Friday of the month, so we're talking about an American classic, and today it's In Cold Blood with Truman Capote. Andrew Rule is with me, the crime journalist based at Melbourne's Herald Sun. Omar Figueres is a crime writer, and he's a co-editor of the online literary journal Blood Lotus. And Dr. Ralph Voss is a retired professor of English at the University of Alabama, and he's written a book about Truman Capote and the legacy of this very, very book. Ralph, let's talk about the trial. The trial wasn't... Well, tell us about where the trial was situated. Garden City, why was it there? Where is it?
Well... The killers had court-appointed attorneys who did not ask for a change of venue, so the trial was actually held in Finney County, Kansas, at Garden City in the courthouse. And the killers had confessed, and the court-appointed attorneys basically were trying to avoid the death penalty. Their best hope for that was to try to work in some psychiatric testimony on the part of experts from the state mental hospital. But the prevailing law in Kansas at the time in capital punishment cases was called the Manotton Rule, which Capote explains pretty well in the book, that basically any doctor, didn't have to be a psychiatrist, was competent to judge whether or not the accused was guilty or innocent based on the single question of did he know that difference between right and wrong and the consequences of his action. And some local physicians in Garden City briefly interviewed Smith and Hickok and pronounced them sane, and every attempt during the trial that the defense attorneys made to bring in some psychiatric testimony was cut off either by the judge or by the objections of the prosecution. So it was pretty much a case of the prosecution, and then it went to the jury. There were some character witnesses for the killers, but the jury did not deliberate very long at all. And this was all in March of 1960, within just, 3 or 4 months after the murders. It was a very swift judgment, the capture, the trial, and then after the conviction, the appeals process took until April of 1965, which, by the way, slowed down Capote's book, annoyingly for him. But that's the trial was very much an open and shut kind of affair.
Let's talk about this relationship, which you can feel in the book, or this sympathy that you can feel in the book, but towards one of the killers, which is Smith. Omar, about 30% of the book is dedicated really to developing the profile of Smith. He is really the major character in the book. What do you make of this? I mean, there has been some suggestion that there was a romantic attachment between Capote and Smith.
There was, and also where Smith talks about, I think he questions his own sexuality throughout a majority of the book as well. But also, I think more so than that, it's Capote's attempt to get inside the head of a killer and create sympathy for this person that could do such heinous, brutal acts to such a kind, loving family as the Clutters. And in order to justify, per se, explain how this could come around, where all these other opportunities were open to him, or, you know, or at least the world was open to him if he would have just not returned to Kansas, and then all this ensued. And it goes into the all of Perry's history, into his diary, the letters that his father wrote to the parole board, and just explores all the many layers of this character, and still, you know, this horrible thing happened at his own hand. So,
what do you make of it, Ralph? I mean, sometimes the criminals call each other honey, and there is something going on there.
Oh, I think that Richard Hickok was very manipulative, and there's every possibility that because the two were cellmates in prison for a short while, that there had been some kind of sexual relationship between Hickok and Smith, and certainly some attraction of sympathy between Capote and Smith, because Capote recognized in Smith some of his own sensibilities, a love of language and words, some artistic ability. And there's a wonderful line that that the screenwriter for the film Capote in 2005, in which the Harper Lee character asks the Capote character, did you fall in love with Perry? And the Capote character answers, well, it's like we were both born in the same house and went out and left by separate doorways. I think there was a great sensitivity that Capote had in sympathy for Smith, because he saw how someone who had the kind of childhood that Smith had could have gone so terribly wrong. And yet Capote knew that for the success of his book, Smith was going to have to hang. And I think that's, to getting back to that word that came up earlier about being ruthless, I think Capote didn't hire flashy defense attorneys to try to help his friends out. He really needed the story to develop the way it developed, and that meant that he had to witness the certainty that they were going to be hanged by the state of Kansas. And I think that's the way it played out. But I definitely think that he muted the gay subtext of In Cold Blood, partly because in 1966 that would have been bad for the book's sales and its reception.
Ralph, it's Andrew here. Do you feel that the strain of doing that, of waiting for the hanging that he needed to finish the book, had a corrosive effect on Capote's personality, and perhaps he was never quite the same later, that it stretched his personality in the way that you stretch a piece of elastic and it never quite comes back to its original shape?
I think it's entirely possible, yes.
We do see it with defence lawyers sometimes who lose capital cases. It seems they become very close to their clients. Their clients die on the gallows, and the defence lawyers are never quite the same afterwards, some of them.
Well, on the 14th of April 1965 in Lansing, Kansas, just after midnight, Smith and Hickok were executed by hanging. Let's listen to another grab from the 1967 film In Cold Blood.
This is to command you, the warden of the Kansas State Penitentiary, that on Wednesday, April 14th, 1965, the clerk of this court
is he the
to issue to the warden of the Kansas State mm-hmm. Penitentiary.
How much does he get paid to hang him?
$300 a man.
Such warden to carry the sentence into execution at the time.
Has he got a name?
We the people.
Our James, clerk of the court of the state of Kansas.
Yes, it's chilling. Has the executioner got a name? And the answer is we the people. Just briefly as we wind up, is it an anti-capital punishment book, Andrew?
No, I don't believe so.
It's often said that it is.
I can see how it could be employed by those who argue against capital punishment easily, but I don't think that was Capote's intention. I think he's a pure writer who's a slave of the written word and of the story, and I don't think he set out to to publish an essay or a you know, to preach.
Right.
Not at all.
Do you have a sense that there is some kind of moral conclusion to be drawn from this story?
No, I don't think so. I think that he just wanted, I agree with Andrew, that he just wanted to see how it would all play out. It started off with a little something, and it's kind of snowballed into something that was out of control and took over his life, where even his letter, his letters reflected that he hated to write it, and he hated to go through it. But it was a force that was going through him. It commanded him, and it was just, it was visceral. He had to do this. This fine needlework of putting this together is the way that he described it.
Ralph, do you feel that we get an insight into who he was through this book?
Capote?
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. He would. I agree that the book can be seen as a screed against capital punishment, but not nearly as much as the film version that was directed by Richard Brooks that you played the excerpt from just a few moments ago. I think the film is definitely more of an anti-capital punishment statement than the book is. But it is interesting to note that after the experience of In Cold Blood, Capote argued against capital punishment. It's as if Smith and Hickok had to die and he had to get that book finished. But afterwards, he argued in at least one interview that I know of that murder, all murder should be a federal crime, and that life in prison would have been appropriate for killers like Smith and Hickok, although he didn't specify, you know, that a mistake was made or something like that when Smith and Hickok were executed.
Well, look, it's been a fascinating conversation, and I do want to thank all three of you for giving us your time. It's been great to talk to all three of you. Thank you, gentlemen.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Dr. Ralph Voss is a retired professor of English at the University of Alabama. He's the author of Truman Capote and the Legacy of In Cold Blood. Andrew Rule is a crime journalist. He writes for Melbourne's Herald Sun. And Omar Figueres is a writer, and he's co-editor of the online literary journal Blood Lotus. Oh, there's one more tweet here from Haki Kilia, who writes, "I'm not a crime reader, but I love Truman Capote's writing. I found this book unputdownable. I miss my bus stop reading it." Well, thank you for that. And thank you for all of you who called and tweeted. What else can you do? You can call or you can tweet or you can ring up people who rang up as well. Thank you. And if you're in the West, you can continue this conversation online. Just pop along to the website and have your say. And if you're a fan of this kind of literature, then there's more for you on Radio National this weekend. On Sunday, we start a six-part series all about true crime writing. It's presented by John Safran, and the series looks at some of the genre's most respected authors and asks them what draws them into these often horrific stories. It looks at the ethics of withholding information and how far writers will stray from the facts in order to make a good story, a topic we've raised today. And the first episode airs this Sunday at 3 p.m. And on that show, you'll hear a conversation with John Berendt, the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. What a wonderful book that is. The 1994 bestseller that opened up the lurid secrets of the town of Savannah in Georgia. So that's Sunday at 3 o'clock, well, just after 3, after the news on RN, and you'll find more details on the RN front page. Look, thanks for listening to me over this past week. It's been great to have your company, and thanks to the team, the executive producer, Linda Lopresti, who's done the heavy lifting this week. Thank you so much, Linda. And the producers, Miyuki Yokoranta, Suzanne Donisthorpe, and Sonia Heidemann, and Rhiannon Brown. Do get well soon, Rhiannon. We need you back here. Technical production from John Jacobs and lots of others. Thanks to all of you. I'm off on 3 weeks' leave now, so I'll talk to you in 3 weeks' time. In fact, I'll be in Berlin when I talk to you next, so that's exciting. And until then, Daniel Browning will be minding the store. Here on RN, there's lots of art over the weekend. Weekend Arts tomorrow at 2 p.m. Kate Evans bringing us Books Plus on Sunday at 2 p.m. But now it's time for Bush Telegraph. That's coming up on RN straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart. Bye-bye.
I have a dream that one day,
in a moment of brilliance, Martin Luther King pulled together all the elements that contributed to his leadership of the civil rights movement. But the March on Washington in August 63 was both a culmination and the start of a new era of struggle.
Free at last! Thank God Almighty, we are free at last!
The Beloved Community, and you can download this encounter from the RN website.